Hi, this is Larry Pena. I'm the editor of Cal Poly Magazine, and we wanted to try something new for this issue. One of my favorite things about this job is all the incredibly interesting conversations I get to have with really smart people. One of those smart people that I got to talk to recently is Mike Latner. He's a poli-sci professor here at Cal Poly. He's currently on a research fellowship with the Union of Concerned Scientists studying the issue of gerrymandering and voter rights more broadly. He was back in town recently and walked me through some of the issues that they're researching and how they're approaching this issue. Now, this recording will be the first part, hopefully, of a podcast we'd like to start working on over the next few months. So if you enjoy this, if you enjoy hearing conversations like this one, let us know, magazine@calpoly.edu. Send us a note and let us know what you thought and who we might do for future subjects coming up for more conversations here on what we're going to call Polycast. Hope you enjoy. Thank you so much. What is gerrymandering? Tell me kind of about this issue.
The essence of gerrymandering is when you have single-seat districts, electoral districts, that are drawn in such a way, that is, the boundaries are drawn in a particular geography so as to benefit one group over another. Right? Or in the case of partisan gerrymandering, they're drawn in such a way so as to advantage the voters of one party over another. Racial gerrymandering, strategy is to advantage the interest of one racial group over another.
Okay. So how does that get done? What's the process by which those lines get drawn?
So most states, the process is done rather ironically by the legislators themselves. And so in most states, the state legislatures, so as per the elections clause of the Constitution, states have control over most of the procedural and administrative aspects of the electoral process in the states for good reason, right? I mean, there was a lot of disagreement over not only what constituted a proper election or registered voter, but what constituted a human being in the late 1700s. And so these questions over citizenship, registration, voter eligibility were essentially kicked to the states. And one of the reasons why we have weak national parties compared to other democracies is that we have strong state parties. And so it's the states that are in control of the process, and whichever party is in control of the political process at the state level, and typically that means having majority control over the state legislature, and ideally for a party it means having control over the entire process. So that means there's no veto points if there's a governor of the other party or if the two chambers of the legislature are split between parties. Then you really don't have the capacity to maximize partisan advantage. But what we saw in our research was that the states that had full control over the process, not surprisingly enough, were the states that really maximized their partisan advantage for whichever party was in control of the process.
Tell me a little bit about how you're addressing this issue and what you're doing in your fellowship.
Okay. All right. So the Kendall Science Fellow Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists is a fellowship that is designed to advance the scientific knowledge between democracy, how democracy functions, and public policy and the role of science in public policy. And so I'm the first voting rights fellow that UCS has brought on, and my work is designed to highlight the connection between advances in social science and election science specifically, and institutional performance. So what's the link between voting rights, which has a long history in American legal studies and in social science. It's one of the most scientifically advanced areas in political science. And the link to public policy. So how does our knowledge about how institutions perform affect policy outcomes and affect the broader policy areas that UCS is concerned about? And traditionally, they've been deeply involved in areas of climate science, nuclear defense, foreign policy, and the like.
Okay. So at the fellowship that you're at, what are you? How are you approaching this topic of congressional districting, and what are you learning?
So we are working, my co-authors and I, from the last book that focused on congressional elections, we're now digging down into the state legislatures. And in anticipation of the next round of redistricting and what we hope to see this year are a number of important decisions by the Supreme Court as to whether or not the court will agree on a scientific standard that is also judiciable, that is, that it also links directly to rights within the Constitution. We're looking ahead and basically trying to plot out the landscape for what the next round of redistricting is going to look like based on what happened in 2012 and in the years preceding. And we're focusing specifically on not just the redistricting process within the state legislatures, which legislatures look to be the worst gerrymandered or the least gerrymandered, and what institutions correlate with, better or worse representation in terms of fairness of voting rights. But we're also looking at the consequences of the gerrymander of 2012. And so one of the things that occurred that's relevant for election science is that once those gerrymandered legislatures went to work after 2012 and really starting in 2010, what we saw was a wave of more restrictive election laws being passed at the state legislative level. Part of this was the result of the 2013 decision, Shelby v. Holder, which invalidated part of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and that gave states more leeway to then implement more restrictive voting laws. And so what we're doing is looking at the consequences of the gerrymander of 2012, how it affected election law and the electoral process in terms of shaping the electorate, voter turnout, voter eligibility in the 10 years after, and then that will set us up for an analysis of what we can expect in the next round of redistricting, and we hope to be able to analyze and include any new decisions that the Supreme Court comes up with regard not just to gerrymandering, but also with regard to other voting rights questions.
Okay. So this is, as you mentioned a couple times, this is a voting rights issue. How does partisan redistricting affect the rights of a citizen or a voter?
After the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was passed, there were a number of landmark Supreme Court cases going all the way up through the 80s and even into the early 90s that really created the case law around racial discrimination in districting. And one of the earliest cases dealt with what's called malapportionment. And malapportionment occurs when you have different populations in districts. And so one of the ways that you can weaken or dilute a voter's vote. So let's say you live in a district in Mississippi, and you live in a district where there are 20,000 eligible voters packed into a district, and all of the surrounding districts have 10,000 voters, right? What that means in terms of representation is that your vote counts half as much, because those people voting in the less populated districts get just as much representation as you do, but you've got twice as many people living in your district. And that was a common tool to disenfranchise African Americans in the South and in other regions as a result of malapportionment. And you can, think about this, how it operates today, because there is still one legislature that has a tremendous amount of malapportionment, and that's the U.S. Senate, right? So yeah. Think about how representation works in the Senate. The state of Wyoming, which has fewer people than live in Orange County, California, they get two senators. 40 million people in California get two senators. Yeah. So who gets screwed in that relationship?
Yeah.
It's Californians, right? So we're underrepresented. Yeah. That same principle used to be at work in state legislatures and in congressional districts. It was outlawed as a result of determining and being able to measure scientifically how much dilution occurs in a given electoral cycle for a specific group. And so that sort of laid the groundwork for redistricting cases and how we think about how individual votes are affected by the way that lines are drawn. In the case of partisan gerrymandering, we're basically talking about the same thing, but we're looking at voters for parties as opposed to people of a particular race. And so we now have what's known as the one person, one vote standard that came out of these cases that says the congressional districts basically have to be equal population. And that's why the census is so important, right? Because in every census now, state legislatures, congressional districts, all electoral districts have to be redrawn, keeping in mind specifically that they have to be roughly equal population, right? So that's how we got rid of that problem. What we haven't dealt with in the question of racial or partisan gerrymandering is that we are still packing Republicans and Democrats or cracking up populations using electoral district boundaries, and we're diluting votes in the exact same way. So it works, the logic is the same as malapportionment. That is, the votes are being diluted depending on what party you vote for. And, you know, we see this in the case of a state like Pennsylvania, which just recently had its congressional districts thrown out by the state Supreme Court, not the federal Supreme Court, which meant that this process moved along much quicker. Last week, the state of Pennsylvania initiated a new congressional plan, and the difference between the old plan and the new plan was that the last few election cycles, so every 2 years you reelect members of the House of Representatives, Democrats make up roughly half the population. That is, when we look at everyone that votes statewide, Democrats equal about half the electorate, Republicans equal the other half of the two-party vote. And Pennsylvania has 18 congressional districts. The plan that was implemented in 2012, Democrats won 5 of 18 congressional seats with roughly half the vote.
Yeah.
Right? And so this new plan looks to be basically fair. That is, there's a very good chance that with a 50-50 vote split, you're basically going to get 9 Democratic seats and 9 Republican seats. So it's not a Democratic gerrymander. It's not a Republican gerrymander. It's basically a fair plan. And it's fair in the sense that it treats every voter equally regardless of which party they vote for.
Yeah, okay. So is that the kind of result that you and your colleagues at Union of Concerned Scientists
Yes.
are looking for kind of across the nation? Or how? What do you guys...
Yeah, so we're looking both at gerrymandering and redistricting, but we're also looking at voting rights more broadly. So we're looking, the research that I'm conducting with UCS now is looking at the electoral cycle as a whole. That is, if you think about, you know, where does the bias in gerrymandering take place? Well, it actually takes place around the end of the process, right? After the votes have been counted and after the votes have basically been aggregated into party seat shares. So it happens at the end of this process that really starts with who's eligible to vote in the first place, right? And so what I'm doing at UCS is looking at voter eligibility requirements and administrative and procedural laws that make it either easier or more difficult to vote. And the same logic holds, though. What I'm looking for is a fair process, right? That's the metric that I'm using is equality. And what we're testing are the extent to which various administrative laws, whether it's automatic voter registration or more restrictive voter registration, the way that voter registration lists are managed, and the extent to which states clean their lists or purge them in some cases, such as the state of Ohio. And we're working our way through the entire process to look at eligibility, registration, also voting laws. So whether or not there's early voting in a state, or whether or not there's absentee voting, mail voting, if there's automatic provisional ballots that are allowed, right? So there are a lot of little laws along the way, if we think about the entire electoral cycle, where it can become either more difficult or less difficult to vote. And those are the points where, if bias is occurring, right, if we're seeing voters not being treated equally, it's along those various stages in the process. And so we're looking at the whole process and then looking at the connection between inequality in terms of participation and in terms of how the law treats voters, and connecting that to the broader policy goals that UCS has traditionally been concerned with. And so my research specifically is looking at the connection between voting rights and environmental justice. So we're looking, we know that there's this general correlation between frontline communities in the environmental justice movement. So that is communities that are located in heavily polluted areas, communities that are exposed to more toxins than other people. We know that there's a correlation. Previous research has shown that there's a correlation between low voter turnout and exposure to many toxins, because these tend to be in poor communities, right?
Yeah.
Poor communities tend to vote less. Poor communities are also subject to more exposure to toxins. What we're looking for is to see if there's any connection between laws that actually might suppress turnout or laws that make them maybe more permissive, so automatic voter registration, online registration, and we're looking to see if what effect those laws have in those specific communities.
Yeah. Okay. Now, none of the things you just described have I heard much talked about in the news? Have I heard talked about on campaign speeches or campaign trails? Or what? Is there less attention kind of focused on these kind of voter representation issues? I mean, what kind of causes that to happen?
Yeah, there are a handful of election laws that have gotten a lot of attention. So one of the things that the Democratic Party hates in particular because they think that it works against the interest of their voters are voter ID laws, right? So again, as a result of the Shelby Holder decision in 2013, as soon as that Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act was basically gutted, a number of states, not surprisingly enough, formerly Confederate states, so we're talking about Texas and North Carolina and a lot of the usual suspects, Alabama, they passed or implemented very restrictive voter ID laws, meaning that voters have to show an identification and when they arrive at the precinct to vote, and the type of ID that is allowable varies from state to state, and you end up having some, you know, very sort of odd administrative decisions. So in Texas, for example, which implemented one of the more strict programs, your gun license was fine as an ID, but if you had a student ID, that didn't count, right? And so there's good reason to believe that there is certainly nefarious intent with the implementation of voter ID laws, and indeed we have many examples of legislatures being open about the fact that they think it's going to hurt particular voters and going to advantage one party over another. But the data is actually not that clear. And so we actually have mixed results in terms of measuring the actual effect of voter ID laws, because in some cases, so in Alabama recently, we had a special election for the Senate, where a Democrat actually won a Senate seat the first time in a generation in Alabama. And yes, it was very, you know, it was very special circumstances given the allegations that the Republican candidate was a child molester. But nevertheless, we see that in that specific election, you've got this very strict voter ID law, and yet it was African-American women who turned out in droves to support the Democratic candidate, yeah, higher in precincts where they're concentrated relative to other precincts. And so the data is just not clear on the effect of voter ID laws and some of these other administrative laws. And so some of them get more attention than others, but we just need more scientific study to actually tease out the effects. And it's likely that the effects may be significant, but they're probably fairly small, right? And that's why it's hard to measure them. Because we just don't have the tools that are refined enough to measure the effects, because there's so many things that affect turnout. Yeah.
How much scientific study goes into the effects of policy, the effects of you know, the way the government operates? It's not something that you kind of traditionally think of when you think like, oh, scientists are going to go in and study government. I mean, it's...
Yeah, well, so it's an area that the relationship between turnout and policy outcomes is pretty well trod ground within political science, but there hasn't been a lot of work on the actual effects of specific election laws on policy, right? And so that's a pretty new area. There is a research history there, but it is we have new tools and we've got new methods now to be looking at this in a way that we really haven't before. So there have been some good studies. The Election Law Journal has published a number of studies that look broadly at the effects of gerrymandering, for example, on whether policy tends to be more conservative or more liberal. But there are these broader general sorts of studies, just because that's where the data is. Whereas I'm looking more specifically at environmental law, let's say, for example, right? And I want to look at what type of environmental law a state legislature produces based on who's sitting in the legislative seats and, you know, to what degree is who's sitting in the seats a function of gerrymandering or other redistricting or voter laws that affect representation.
There's a phrase that I keep hearing kind of as I look into this topic of politicians choosing their voters rather than voters choosing their politicians.
Right.
I mean, what does that mean to you, and how does this come into play in what you're studying?
Yeah, so when you think about the traditional way that districts have been drawn in the United States, it very much is the process is one of legislators sitting down, looking at maps, looking at where their voters are, and drawing their lines so as to benefit themselves. Now, when we say it is benefiting individuals, that really doesn't fall into the category of partisan gerrymandering, right? That's more of an incumbent gerrymander, and we've seen that certainly in the past. So in California, prior to the adoption of a nonpartisan redistricting commission, which is how California now draws its districts, what we saw in the 2000 redistricting was very much what I would call an incumbent protection plan. Yeah. That is, Republican leaders got together with Democratic leaders. They both agreed that they didn't want to go through the lawsuits and things that they did in the 1990s, where the courts ended up drawing a plan like they did just recently in Pennsylvania. And they basically made a deal and said, look, let's just make safe seats. Republicans were okay with that because even though they're the minority party, the way the budget process works in California, you need two-thirds of a majority to pass the budget. So as long as they could stop tax increases, they were basically okay with that deal. Yeah. And that gerrymander was so successful that in three layers of government, so the state assembly, the state senate, and the congressional seats, there was one seat in the entire cycle of 10 years of elections that changed party hands. So very, very effective incumbent protection, right?
Yeah.
And historically, it's changed. In the late 1800s, we actually saw a huge amount of pure partisan gerrymandering, where state legislatures were really, in a couple of cases, actually determined the composition of Congress by focusing on the party. And that's because they had strong party leaders. Candidates didn't have as much of a role in the process, and so party leaders could really do what they wanted to. And we're getting back into that sort of a period now. That's really what we saw in the 2012 gerrymander with this partisan polarization, right? The nation's polarized along partisan lines more than it has been really since the Civil War. And under those conditions, party leaders can extract a lot of discipline from candidates because they can punish them with drawing bad districts if they don't go along. And so we really saw this sort of hyper-partisanship reflected in the gerrymandering process in 2012.
Yeah. I mean, what was it that made it kind of shift that way and has maybe become a bigger issue than it has been before? Was it about 2012 or 2010?
Well, so there are competing explanations, right? So one explanation is demographic, essentially. And the demographic explanation says, look, we're moving into places as a country where we want to live next to people that are more like us, right? So Democrats want to live with other Democrats, Republicans want to live with other Republicans, and so we're basically self-sorting, right? And so that explanation says it really doesn't have anything to do with gerrymandering per se. It's just the fact that it's harder to draw fair or competitive districts because people are essentially segregating themselves, right? Our research in the 2016 book showed that that was not a viable explanation because there, one, wasn't that much sorting that took place in that previous 10 years compared to other decades. And what we found was the most plausible explanation was actually that the Supreme Court themselves helped create this disaster. That in 2004, there was a very controversial decision called Veith versus Jubilee, which was actually had to do with Pennsylvania's districts. And in that decision, the conservatives split with the liberals, so you had the four liberals, the four conservatives, with Justice Scalia eventually writing the plurality opinion. Justice Kennedy was the swing vote, and he sided with Scalia and the conservatives on the finding that there wasn't currently a scientific standard that the courts could use to determine how much gerrymandering was too much. But he held out hope, and he dissented with Scalia and the majority, that there could ever be a scientific standard, right? Scalia and the conservatives wanted to just say, look, this is politics. The courts really have no business getting into what parties are doing, and there is no way that there could be a judiciable standard. Kennedy held out and said, well, just because there isn't one now doesn't mean there won't be one in the future. And that's why all these cases that have gone to the Supreme Court, Maryland and Wisconsin, basically, they should just start their brief saying, Dear Justice Kennedy, because everyone knows they all know he's the swing vote, and they all know that he's looking for a specific type of standard.
Yeah. I mean, is that standard emerging? Is that something that...
Absolutely, yeah. No, there's actually, back in before Veith, the emerging consensus, the scientific consensus, is what we call symmetry, right? And the symmetry standard basically... well, I should back up a little way, and I'll give you a sort of general theory of political equality and then how we get to a scientific standard of symmetry. So the highest standard of political equality is basically proportional representation, right? Mm-hmm. So that the percentage of votes that a party gets should be the percentage of seats that it gets. And we see this in a number of democracies that most of the world's democracies have some sort of proportional system. The purest examples are in like the Netherlands and Israel, where basically whatever percentage of votes a party gets, that's the percentage of seats that they get in the national legislature, right? The Voting Rights Act and revisions to the Voting Rights Act specifically, and this was relevant for the racial redistricting cases, specifically say that voters are not entitled to proportional representation, right? So we are not going to design, nor do we need to design, a system that requires that if a state is 30% African American, that they get 30% of the seats, right? Because the court felt that that was relying on race too much, right, as a sort of essential characteristic. And so the task for political science has been to find a standard that isn't as high as proportional representation, but still meets constitutional requirements of political equality. Right, and that's been the goal. And so for the last two decades, the symmetry standard has emerged. And what symmetry measures is basically whether or not the number or percentage of votes that are wasted in an election are equal for each party, right? Or is the plan, the districting plan, somehow treating the voters of one party differently than the other, right? And so the measure that we use in our book is the political bias measure developed by Andrew Gelman and Gary King, and then it's been updated in recent papers over the decades. And it basically is a test. It's a simulation where it swings a statewide vote, right? So if you take California, for example, Democrats have an advantage, right? Democrats are the largest party, and they typically get about 75% of the seats with a little over 60% of the vote, right? The question is, what would happen if Republicans got 60% of the vote? Would they too get 70% of the seats, right? And so that tells us to what degree the plan itself is treating voters equally. That's the standard that we use. That's the dominant standard. Over the last, particularly since Veith, several new ways of measuring symmetry have been developed. And so Eric McGee and Nick Stephanopoulos at Davis in Chicago have developed what they call the efficiency gap. That was a new and sexy measure over the last few years. Political scientists have been looking at it quite a bit. And it basically measures the efficiency or the wasting of votes, whether or not it's equal between parties. Right, so it's a slightly different measure. Mathematically, it's a little different, and it's not measuring quite the same thing. In addition, there's the mean median gap. So that's another measure that looks at the vote percentage of the median district for a party, and then looks at the mean percentage, and to the degree that those are different, that is a measure that the party's voters are being packed into to a district, because that affects the mean, right, in a way that the median isn't affected. So we've got these several measures. The nice thing about them is that they actually all converge on the worst cases of gerrymandering, right? So regardless of what measure you use, Pennsylvania looks like a horrible gerrymander. Yeah. North Carolina looks like a horrible gerrymander. And so, you know, while there are certainly discrepancies and there's infighting within political scientists about what measures the best and what's actually being measured, for the purpose of the court, there's no question that symmetry is not only a viable measure, it's judiciable. That is, the courts, one of the things that the courts worry about is that they're going to be in a position of getting lots of lawsuits and everyone saying, look, this is a gerrymander, that's a gerrymander. The nice thing about these measures is because they converge on the worst cases, there's not a lot of guessing room, right? I mean, it'll be easy for the courts to say, okay, clearly by any measure, this is much worse than most of the cases that we see.
Yeah.
So they'll be able to point out the worst gerrymanders and at least get rid of the most egregious cases if they apply a standard.
Okay. So kind of from a policy perspective, is there a way to enforce these kind of measurements to make elections and make districts more fair kind of universally? I mean, what's the solution going forward, and how does that change the way our democracy looks?
Sure. So the most the litigation solution is the one where the courts become involved, right? Yeah. So basically that's a process of lawsuits. So if the courts come up with a standard, the next day you'll see a flurry of lawsuits, yeah. and they're going to work their way up through the court system. That's the litigation path. Now we've got a standard. Now we're going to apply it, right?
Yeah.
And basically, in the same way that the courts applied the Civil Rights Act and applied the Voting Rights Act, it's through litigation. The policy solution is to actually just change the way that we draw districts. And so one of the things that our research showed pretty clearly was that states that adopt redistricting commissions and other bipartisan ways of determining districts, they don't have as biased of districts, right? Yeah. Surprise, surprise. So California went from having a fairly moderate Democratic-leaning gerrymander that was really an incumbent protection plan to having one of the fairest plans in the country as a result of adopting its commission. And we see this throughout the states, that when states do adopt not just advisory commissions, but commissions that actually have teeth and actually force the legislatures to accept a plan, you know, they may give them a variety of plans to choose from, but they've got to choose a commission's plan. That is a way of reducing bias. And it's a way of removing the incentive, or the not the incentive, but the ability for parties to maximize their own advantage.
Yeah. Okay. How does that improve American government going forward?
Well, that's a much more complicated question, right? So there's disagreement over the degree to which gerrymandering causes partisan polarization, right? I mean, we know that partisan polarization makes governing much more difficult, right? Because there's literally no one left in the middle to make deals with, right? And democracy ultimately depends on compromise and deal-making and bargaining. And so, you know, it's no surprise that we see the last few Congresses been some of the most unproductive or least productive Congresses that we've seen in American history. And it's because no one's talking to each other, right? And our system is not designed that way. It's designed to work with fluid coalitions.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we would expect to see under, once certain types of gerrymandering are ruled unconstitutional and done away with, specifically the sort of incumbent protection plans, right? Because those are the types of gerrymandering that actually incentivize partisanship. Because if you're in a safe district, then you're really competing for the median voter in your own party rather than the median voter in the election, right?
Right.
And so we can see, and we have good evidence to suggest, that polarization is actually exacerbated by really safe congressional districts. So if we could make districts a little more competitive in terms of getting a fair plan, we would expect to see less polarization and presumably more cooperation. Of course, maximizing competition is not the same thing as getting a fair plan. Right, these are two different things, and so you can get a fair plan that still has basically a number of safe seats, but then you've got some competitive seats in the middle, so that you're basically getting a somewhat proportional sort of outcome at the state level. So there are a number of things that are involved in how districting actually affects governance and policy, and gerrymandering is part of that puzzle, but it's a much more complex puzzle, and certainly, to the extent that we're really concerned about party competition and the way that legislatures behave, one of the things that I think we're going to be running up against in the near future are some of the fundamental limits of the type of electoral system that we use. And what I mean by that is that even if we create a bunch of fair plans, right, so we've basically done away with extreme partisan gerrymandering, we are still going to face the fundamental limits of the type of districts that we use and the type of electoral formulas that we use, which are themselves sort of crudely majoritarian. That is, the fact that we use single-seat districts to elect members of most of our legislatures means that, by definition, we can't have very proportional outcomes, right? And so in the case of California, we are always going to have to deal with the fact that there's going to be what we call this seat bonus, right? Whichever is the largest party tends to get more than their share of seats. And so the Democrats are really advantaged by that system in California, because even under a fair plan, they're going to get, you know, the 70% of the seats with 60% of the vote. And what that means is that voters are always going to be discriminated against in a lesser sense. Maybe not to the degree that they are under an extreme partisan gerrymandering. But urban Republicans, for example, are always going to have their votes diluted because they basically don't have a chance to contribute to the representation of the Republican Party. Rural Democrats, basically, to the degree that this rural-urban polarization that we saw really strong in the 2016 race, to the extent that that maintains or even gets worse, rural liberals are going to be underrepresented, right? Urban conservatives or Republicans or libertarians are going to be underrepresented. And so that's something that we're probably going to need to deal with at some point in the near future. But that's a feature of our system. That's not a bug, right? I mean, gerrymandering is a bug. It's something that we can work on that and we can fix it, given the tools that we have. But there are other types of bias, types of distorting of the aggregation of votes to seats that are actually part of the system. They're not a bug. And so that's something that we need to think about for future work.